can help us finish a task more quickly. Paradoxically, there are even times when intense stress can help balance the brain. There seems to be a depth and even spiritual appreciation in people who have recovered from trauma. You've probably heard at least one story of a near-death experience that changed a person's whole perspective. In the 90s, the term post-traumatic growth was coined. While there are, of course, negative aspects to experiencing trauma, there is also an upside. In fact, up to 90% of survivors report a positive aspect of post-traumatic growth. They pursue more fulfilling goals or have a renewed appreciation for life. Life stresses can make us more resilient when processed in a healthy way. One study showed older adults who got through significant stressful events like divorce were actually better able to deal with smaller everyday stressors. We all have a point where eustress becomes distress. The best way to handle the stresses of life is to raise this point by balancing our brains. Chapter 3. The Mind-Body Connection. Maria had a long medical history with some very complicated and difficult to treat illnesses. But the most troubling part of Maria's story was how anxious, sad, and scared she felt all the time. I'll never forget the first few minutes we spent together because I immediately had a sense of how each day felt like a struggle for her. While I felt a tremendous amount of compassion, I also felt a sense of inadequacy as I immediately knew she was looking to me as her next great hope in a long line of doctors she had turned to for relief. Maria struggled with a variety of physical and psychological ailments, including irritable bowel syndrome, fibromyalgia, insomnia, and generalized anxiety disorder. She described herself as a hypochondriac and reported a list of other possible illnesses, including chronic fatigue syndrome and possible parasitic infections. She tried both mainstream and alternative treatments, and nothing seemed to work. She felt hopeless and scared, and she was financially depleted from her healthcare bills. Each new specialist she saw was supposed to be the one, and with every new diet, regimen, or medication came a sense of disappointment when it didn't live up to her high expectations. After hearing this history, one of the first things I did with Maria was to talk about the fact that I was not likely to be the answer to all her prayers. It was extremely unlikely her problems were purely psychological or purely physical. Psychological well-being affects physical health and vice versa, in a very real and measurable way. For Maria, this had become a downward spiral. Worrying that originates in the mind can physically raise cortisol levels in the body, which leads to inflammation and lower levels of anxiety-relieving serotonin and GABA. This can negatively affect digestion and energy and is associated with a variety of physical ailments. The more physical symptoms she felt, the more she worried. The more she worried, the more physical dysfunction was exacerbated. This cycle went on and on. In more complex cases of brain drain like Maria's, a fix will usually be a combination of treatments that need to be put together in just the right amounts at the right time. It's like cooking a delicate souffle. If you don't separate the eggs correctly or if you bake it for too long, you will ruin this delicately constructed work of art that seems to be effortlessly suspended in air when prepared just right. Instead of cooking a complex dish with a variety of ingredients, Maria was trying to cook a souffle with just one ingredient each time. 1 month, her problem was gluten, and she hoped a gluten-free diet would cure everything. The next, it was a brand new prescription medication or supplement she would try. Then it was on to Chinese medicine and herbal remedies. The fact is, most of Maria's treatments had some merit. But when used alone, none would be the silver bullet cure she was hoping for. As a psychotherapist, I began by asking Maria what she had learned about herself from her treatment thus far. "Well, I learned that my body is just really messed up. I'm scared that nothing is going to work. I'm never going to feel normal." She was in tears immediately. "And lately, I'm scared that I have some rare, terrible illness, which only makes everything worse. I can feel my belly acting up right now because I'm getting upset. Of course, now I'm horrified and embarrassed because I'm afraid I'm going to have to run up to the bathroom any second. This is what happens. I already scoped it out before I came in here. It's so isolating. I don't want to attend social situations, and I certainly don't want to go on dates like this." "I can see how hard this has been for you," I said, "and I appreciate the trust you've already placed in me by talking about your condition. When you just acknowledged your condition and fears right here and now with me, make your anxiety go up or down, or is it unchanged?" "Well, I'm a little relieved that if I do run out of here, you'll know why," Maria said as her tears began to get softer. "And that helps a little bit, I guess. And I'm sure that actually decreased the likelihood that you'll have to run out, since stress makes your stomach problems worse. And tell me about my response to you. Do I look horrified, judgmental, or grossed out right now?" "Well, no," she said, as she cracked a smile. "But you're a professional." "I guess that's true," I said. "But I'm also a human being who you just met. You had the courage to immediately share something with me that's embarrassing for you. I'm guessing you usually keep this a secret, so you're already doing something differently. Do you think that maybe a piece of your anxiety comes from you overestimating people's responses? I wonder if that makes the anxiety and stomach pains worse." "Yes," Maria said with tears in her eyes, "probably. It does feel good to be able to talk about this with you and to feel like you understand me and that my condition makes sense to you. I feel like a crazy person most of the time, which is a big part of the problem." I asked Maria if I could use hypnosis to help her retrieve old memories that could shed some light on her experience, because I had a feeling this was rooted in childhood trauma. We were going to look for times in her life where she had a similar feeling of feeling crazy. "Close your eyes for a second and pay attention to that feeling in your body. I want you to just float back and look for the times in your life where you felt that same feeling." Maria began to sob. "My mom." "What did your mom say to you?" I asked. In our work together, Maria recovered the physical sensations of sickness that accompanied the first time she told her mother that she was being sexually abused by her neighbor. Her mother didn't believe her, and she kept the secret for months. Maria was aware of the abuse, but she had forgotten that feeling of being ill. "Keeping that secret made me feel crazy. I kept that a secret for months until I finally told the school psychologist and they arrested the guy," she said. "When you talk about that, where do you feel that in your body?" I asked. "My stomach," she replied. "Tell me about it. If you were to give it a color, what color would that feeling be? Describe the texture to me." "Well, I guess it feels heavy, like dread," she replied. "Black, churning like sludge. I just can't escape. Oh my gosh, I can actually feel something moving in my belly as I'm talking about this." Just like that. That was how my treatment with Maria started. While this first interaction wasn't a cure, it was certainly a significant step in the right direction. At the end of our session, I urged her to continue working with her primary care doc, her GI doctor, acupuncturist, other specialists, as each healthcare professional has invaluable and appropriate expertise. I didn't want her to fall into her normal all-or-nothing approach to healthcare. While it is understandable to believe that something isn't working if it doesn't make you feel 100% better, It was important to understand that what she'd been doing was important. In fact, sometimes not responding to a treatment is helpful, since it can help rule out a suspected cause, or it could help Maria and her providers figure out what wasn't working. Perhaps she would benefit from the wonders of combination therapy by putting effective treatments together. She might not feel a 100% improvement with one change, but when she started to put something that helped her 10% with five other strategies that also helped 10%, she'd get a 60% improvement. That's significant enough to improve one's quality of life. Maria stuck with her other providers, and I became part of a team of healthcare providers she worked with. I continued to treat her on a regular basis for months, and we reprocessed the trauma that affected her brain and body in very real ways. Together, we sorted out what part of her problems were related to untreated trauma, stress, and a drained brain. The beauty was that as our treatment progressed, she became the expert of her own experience and gained a sense of control over her health. Stress and the body. Maria's experiences are important because they show just how powerful our thoughts are in creating a drained brain, and how important healing a drained brain is in the long term. We need to manage our thoughts, to manage our stress, to manage our health, to manage our stress. It's all one big loop. The mind affects the body, and the body affects the mind. Just about every physical disease is affected by our brains and stress levels. Heart disease, high blood pressure, cancer, stroke, obesity, diabetes, irritable bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, fibromyalgia, multiple sclerosis, headaches, migraines, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, herpes, HIV, HPV, the common cold, the flu, shingles, aging, premature death. The list goes on and on. No matter what specialist you have seen in your life for various conditions, they probably tell you that managing stress will help you with any ailment you may be facing. Stress can directly cause physical disease, contribute to it when mixed with other factors, or exacerbate symptoms and contribute to flares in existing ones. Unfortunately, the paradox is that managing stress is incredibly elusive when you're dealing with illness and the inherent fatigue, worry, pain, and malaise that come with it. Physical disease and brain drain affect each other in multiple systems throughout your body. Pain creates negative thought patterns that can spike cortisol levels that then affect digestion and other bodily processes. Worry that begins in the brain activates the sympathetic nervous system, which affects the body as your muscles tense and your heart pumps more quickly. Stress can lead to the release of cholesterol and triglycerides into the bloodstream, which affects the heart and other parts of the body. Your immune system suffers as severe stress can release your natural killer cell activity that protects you against viruses and cancer cells by 50%. Anticipation and stress can increase the numbers of bad bacteria like E. coli, while decreasing good bacteria like Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus, which can lead to digestion and mood problems. The mind-body connection is indeed powerful. In fact, I think the term mind-body, spelled with no hyphen and referred to as a single entity, is a more accurate way to think about this relationship. They're far more connected than people think. There are so many examples of how the mind and body are connected that there's no way I can give you an exhaustive list without boring the pants off you, but here are a few of my favorite examples just to give you a taste. First, let's look at irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, and upset stomach. These are the two most common digestive disorders, and they affect up to 20% of the American population. Worldwide, IBS itself affects 15% of the adult population, but is still not well understood. While it is often treated with cognitive behavioral therapy and a variety of medications like antidepressants, the condition is often unresponsive. This has a lot to do with the complex interplay of the mind and body. To most successfully treat illness, you have to use a whole person-centered approach that requires far more effort and adherence to lifestyle changes than taking a pill. A 2007 study demonstrated the complex mind-body connection inherent in IBS. This study sought to see if psychological factors like personality traits, mood, and the way you perceive the illness increases the likelihood of being diagnosed with IBS. The answer was yes. This study used patients who were first diagnosed with gastroenteritis, a condition involving inflammation of the GI tract that usually only lasts for a few weeks. None of the patients had a history of IBS. Then researchers sought to see how the mind affected what happened next. Patients who had a tendency to interpret the initial physical illness in a pessimistic fashion were more likely to go on and develop IBS. Thus, psychotherapy can help the minds of people prone to IBS by changing pessimism into optimism. This psychological tool can be combined with specific dietary restrictions, for example, a low FODMAP diet that addresses the guts of people with this specific condition. Another difficult to treat and debilitating condition relating to mind-body-brain drain is chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, which affects up to 3% of adults. In 2016, a breakthrough in research may have shed some light on the cause of this disease. Like other mind-body conditions, it is a real physical disease. After being exposed to a stressor, people with CFS get stuck in a metabolic state similar to hibernation in animals. 80% of the metabolites, which help produce energy in cells, were decreased. This explains the extreme lack of energy, because cells are in a non-aging hypometabolic mode. Cells go into this hibernation-like state as a defense, but in people with CFS, they get stuck in it. While more research is needed, the lead researcher on the study hypothesized that the right diet and supplements could wake the body back up. Even though more must be learned about the biological underpinnings of CFS, stress clearly plays a role in the potential development of the disease. Theoretically, extreme stress could trigger the cellular defense mechanism that leads to the development of CFS. Experiencing childhood trauma has been shown to increase the risk of developing the disease. A study examining 30,000 veterans showed that the more stress and trauma the soldiers were exposed to, the greater the chance they had both PTSD and chronic fatigue syndrome-like illness. In the largest study of chronic fatigue syndrome in children, published in 2016, researchers found the disease to be more common in teens than previously thought, with 2% of 16-year-olds meeting diagnostic criteria. Stressed-out teens, those reporting financial difficulties in their family, housing problems, and a lack of maternal support, were more likely to have chronic fatigue syndrome. Another disease with strong mind-body ties is fibromyalgia, which affects somewhere between 2 and 8% of the population. Fibromyalgia is characterized by chronic, widespread pain. Recently, there is more and more evidence that stress is one of many causes that also affects the progression of the disease. Research has shown that children with PTSD are more likely to be diagnosed with fibromyalgia. This association has also been shown in adults. While I can't say the sexual abuse experienced by Maria, the woman I discussed at the beginning of this chapter, caused her fibromyalgia, research does show people with a history of sexual abuse are more likely to have the disease. There are clearly complex biological and psychological risk factors at play. The disease has even been associated with the way people process serotonin, a neurotransmitter that many drained people are low in. An association has also been shown between fibromyalgia and an anxious personality. To other very common maladies that are the number one and number five leading causes of death are heart disease and stroke, respectively. Like digestive disorders, these diseases show very strong links to stress when you look at some of the shocking statistics. The American Heart Association says stress is one of the top precursors of cardiovascular disorders. Postmenopausal women who had panic attacks had triple the risk of experiencing a stroke or coronary event. In another study, women with the most phobic anxiety were 59% more likely to have a heart attack and also more likely to die from one. Other research shows that both men and women with an anxiety disorder and history of heart disease were twice as likely to have a heart attack compared with people with no anxiety disorder and a history of heart disease. While hypertension or high blood pressure isn't directly caused by anxiety, there is a dangerous link. Triggering brain-draining cortisol spikes with too much stress or anxiety is associated with an increased risk of hypertension and thus heart disease. This association between anxiety and hypertension is present for all the different anxiety disorders a drained brain person may be diagnosed with. Being drained in mind and body is also associated with diabetes and weight gain. Stress can indirectly cause diabetes. When you're stressed, levels of your main feel-good, stress-relieving neurotransmitter, serotonin, go down. When serotonin levels are low, you're more likely to crave and indulge in processed carbohydrates, flour, and sugar, since carbohydrates release a surge of serotonin. Of course, doing this too often can cause diabetes. Stress affects weight gain in complex ways. When the brain is drained and stress hormones, including cortisol, spike, the body is more likely to store fat in the belly area. It's important to note that we all have to get through stressful situations. The difference is in how we get through these tasks. One study measured cortisol levels in women after they all had to do the same stressful task, timed arithmetic. While all subjects felt taxed, it was the women who didn't have coping skills who were left feeling helpless. No surprise, these women had higher levels of cortisol in their body, and they were also more likely to have excess belly fat. And although you're probably well aware of the dangers of obesity, it seems that this mind-body stress response could even be more hazardous to your health than you realize. Surprisingly, researchers found fit people who stored their fat in their midsection were more likely to die than those who were actually obese but who stored fat in other areas other than the midsection. The risk was quite pronounced, especially in men. Men with a normal body mass index, or BMI, with excess belly fat were twice as likely to die as those with higher body mass indexes with fat stored in other places. Women with excess belly fat and a normal BMI showed a 32% spike in mortality risk compared with overweight women with fat stored in other areas. There is also a mind-body link to one of the scariest physical diseases, cancer. Your psychological stress response can increase the likelihood of the disease and speed its course. Personalities deemed stress-prone and that had poor coping skills were linked to both higher cancer incidence and poorer cancer survival. While there is no direct cause and effect relationship, we know stress makes your body more hospitable to cancer cells and negatively affects your immune system. Stress hormones block anoiacus, the programmed cell death that helps diseased cancer cells from spreading. When too many stress hormones are present, metastasis, the spread of cancerous cells from one organ or part of the body to another, is more likely to occur. In 2016, a groundbreaking study demonstrated stress can create cancer highways throughout the lymphatic system. Scientists noted that cancer spread more quickly in mice who are stressed out. Previously, it was known that cancer can spread through the bloodstream since stress hormones increase blood vessel formation, which helps malignant cells spread. But this animal study also demonstrated that by activating the fight, flight, or freeze response and the resulting spike of adrenaline too often, lymph formation sped up. Stress hormones also changed the lymph vessels, which allowed these cells to escape faster. Thus, two disastrous changes were noted. First, new cancer highways out of the tumor were created for the cells to travel. Second, the speed limit went up so the tumor cells could flow more rapidly. Thus, the effect of stress on cancer is worse than previously thought, since an entirely separate system has been shown to be affected by stress. It's important to note that just because these diseases have ties to stress and anxiety does not make them purely in people's heads or demonstrate a clear-cut cause and effect relationship between stress and contracting the disease. It's likely the interaction between something physical, like exposure to a virus, and one's genetically programmed and environmentally learned response to stressors then unleashes a cascade of responses in the body that may be difficult to undo. Remember, the word psychosomatic itself means mind, psycho, and body, somatic. You could say almost every disease or condition is technically psychosomatic, because which one of them doesn't affect both mind and body? Stress and the brain. Stress not only affects physical disease, but also the very structure of our brains, making us even more likely to experience a drained brain. A number of studies have been done to shed light onto what happens in people's brains when they go through something stressful. One study demonstrated a link between a smaller hippocampus in people who experienced long-lasting stress like childhood abuse. Why does this matter? This part of the brain helps you remain resilient in the face of stress and is involved in mood regulation. It also helps you to monitor the safety of your environment and store dangerous images in your long-term memory so you can avoid them in the future. It does all these things as part of its duties of regulating your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. But chronic stress can confuse the hippocampus and lead to turning signals for cortisol on instead of off, which can hardwire you into a constant state of fight, flight, or freeze. The hippocampus is also a very important part of the brain as we age, since it's one of only two areas of the adult brain where neurogenesis, the growth of new brain cells, is present. Neurogenesis in the hippocampus isn't just important for dementia prevention. It's also important to prevent anxiety, since the growth of brain cells in this part of the brain has been shown to reduce it. Another study utilizing brain scans was conducted at Yale in 2012. This groundbreaking study found that stress can shrink the brain fairly quickly if you're unable to handle it. It also showed shrinkage in another part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex. As it relates to mind-body-brain drain, this part of the brain is responsible for physiological functions like blood pressure and glucose levels, which, of course, means havoc in the body when the system is faulty. The prefrontal cortex also acts as the brakes on stress, rumination, and impulsive behavior when other parts of your brain flood you with stress hormones. As I said before, the mind affects the body, and the body affects the mind. Stress and brain drain go hand in hand. Pitfall thought patterns. One form of stress that I see regularly when treating people with drained brains is what I refer to as pitfall thought patterns. These are simply negative ways of thinking that we can get trapped in. And when we do, they prevent us from reaching our highest potential, both psychologically and physically. Here are the 7 pitfall thought patterns that are linked to brain-draining conditions like anxiety and insomnia. 1. Paralysis analysis. This type of thinking involves stewing and ruminating in anxious thoughts, preventing productive action from occurring. For example, I wonder why Harmony got that account, not me. Does my boss like her better than me? I wonder if it's because of that mistake I made last month on that account. My boss said he wasn't mad, but maybe he was and just didn't want to tell me. He did give me sort of a funny look this morning. I'm so behind on this project, but I just can't stop thinking about this. I'm freaking out. 2. Permanence. This type of thinking falsely assumes that just because something is a problem right now, it will always be a problem. Mood congruent recall in the brain lights up negative memories in the brain, creating the illusion that you've always been stressed and therefore will always be stressed in the future. For example, dealing with my dad's health problems is so hard and it feels like it's never going to end. My life is hard, and it feels like it's always been this way. This dark cloud isn't going to pass. 3. Personalization. This type of thinking places the blame entirely on yourself for something not going your way. The error here is that there are multiple people as well as circumstances that are involved in unfavorable outcomes. Perhaps there were some things you'd like to change, but it's rarely entirely your fault, just as it's rarely entirely the other person's fault. For example, my divorce was my fault. It happened because I'm unlovable. I must not be capable of being in a relationship. I'm weak. 4, pervasiveness. This type of thinking allows something that is affecting one area of your life to spread to all the areas of your life. For example, what a stressful day. I just can't deal with one more person. I'm going to skip yoga and get out of my dinner plans. I'd rather just sit alone by myself in front of the TV and eat pizza. 5, pessimistic. This type of thinking considers the worst case catastrophic scenario. It dwells in the possible, not the probable. For example, if I don't get my anxiety under control, I'll probably start having panic attacks several times a day. How will I ever be able to work if I have uncontrollable panic attacks? If I started having one while I'm driving, I'd crash my car and kill someone. Maybe I'll get sent to prison. How would I ever live with that guilt? 6, polarized. This type of thinking has a binary black or white pattern. The words always or never are frequently found in this type of thought pattern. For example, I've always had sleeping problems. If my insomnia isn't 100% better, then I've failed. There are 2 types of people, good sleepers and insomniacs. I'm the latter. 7, psychic. This type of thinking expects people around us to read our minds without us verbalizing what we need. It can also mean falsely assuming we know what someone else is thinking when they haven't verbalized their opinion. For example, my friends aren't helping me. Can't they see I'm struggling? They haven't even asked me how I'm doing tonight, and if you look at my face, they can see something's wrong. If they really knew me and cared about my well-being, they'd know this and would do something to help me feel better. I feel so alone. When we don't address pitfall thought patterns, they can create self-fulfilling prophecies that turn irrational fears into realities. For example, worrying that you have a rare disease spikes cortisol levels. This depresses the immune system, and now you actually are more likely to develop diseases. In traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, I help patients identify the pitfall thought patterns that are affecting them. When you're trapped in one of these patterns, life feels harder than it should, and you'll feel run down. And it's not just because your mood. You're actually changing your biology when you live in this state, because you are stressed. Brain drainers like cortisol go up, while the brain balancing neurotransmitters go down. As you now know, this can wreak havoc throughout the body. Muscles get tense. It becomes difficult to breathe deeply. Digestion suffers. This activates the feedback loop of stress, and it can be difficult to pull yourself out of the downward spiral of worry and fatigue. The autonomic nervous system gets caught in a sympathetic dominant state. A negative thought creates negative action. A negative action creates tension. Tension creates negative mood states. Negative mood states lead to more negative thoughts, and so on. We do truly live in a mind-body state. Luckily, you'll learn a way to pull yourself out of these pitfall thought patterns through energy-based cognitive therapy, or EBCT, which you'll learn about in a later chapter. Chapter 4. Wired for Brain Drain. While we all experience pessimistic thoughts and pitfall thought patterns at one time or another, some of us are more prone to be affected by them. We are just genetically wired to experience the feelings that lead to a drained brain. That's exactly what the case was for Anthony, a young entertainment industry executive who was referred to me by his primary care physician. He experienced his first panic attack 2 years prior, a month after he was promoted to vice president at a television production company. The attack was frightening for him. He had always been an anxious person, both as an adolescent and young adult, but the panic attacks were especially troubling. Like many people with anxiety, there was also some mild depression present. Now I have about one predictable panic attack a month, usually before a big meeting, he said. But others just come out of nowhere. The other day I was sitting at my desk and bam! I asked Anthony about what strategies were working for him. Well, Xanax works, but I don't want to be like the rest of my family. They all pop Xanax like candy. When I had to meet with our president the other day, I had taken two. I didn't have a panic attack, but I also didn't feel like I was on point either. And I felt groggy. My greatest fear is that I'm cursed with bad genes that are going to make me anxious for the rest of my life. I knew this wasn't the case. Both as someone who has treated many people who seem to be wired for worry and as someone who comes from a family of worriers. I remember being in the car with my grandparents as a kid. Any light tap on the brakes by my grandpa would elicit a response from my grandma. I can still picture it clearly. My grandma would gasp as she put out her hand and yelled, "Ward!" My mom has the same startle response. Same gasp, same hand, same yell. It's why my stepdad jokingly calls her by my grandma's first name sometimes. And then there's me, always thinking about the future, looking for evidence, usually financial or health-related, that I'm not going to be okay. I know I have my mom's genes for worry. Pair that with some life experience. My parents' bankruptcy when I was 7 and my brother's stroke when I was 15, and you can see how nature and nurture collided to make me a worrier. Of course, there was evidence of my genetic tendency for anxiety before this. I was that inconsolable, wailing child at preschool who never wanted to be without his mom. The two things I most frequently worry about today, money and health. My parents' financial ruin and losing everything taught me, even if you have it all, you can lose it all in a moment. Before the bankruptcy, we lived a charmed life. My father was a physician and we had a home with ocean views. That was one day. The next, my parents filed for bankruptcy and divorced. We were left penniless after a big real estate deal went bad. I'm sure the stress of financial ruin weighed heavily on my father. In fact, his drained brain was a major cause of his first heart attack. The last one took his life a few years ago. My brother's rare brain disease, which was diagnosed after he had a major stroke at the age of 10, stitched a similar message into my brain. Even if there's no evidence of disease right now, you could be walking around with a life-threatening condition. After all, that's what happened to my brother. It's what my personal experience told me was true with a capital T. For people without a genetic tendency toward brain drain, these experiences may not have caused a significant amount of lasting stress. But for those people who are wired this way, it's important to understand that you need to be especially vigilant about caring for your brain. It's also important to realize that you are not simply doomed to be anxious, overwhelmed, and drained. While you may be genetically prone to it, you have the power to overcome this through how you live your life. This intersection between nature and nurture is an exciting part of science called epigenetics that looks at how your environment influences the expression of your genes. Studies in this area of research show that our genes just load the gun. It's our life experiences that pull the trigger as genes are then turned on or expressed. This explains why only some people who have the mutated BRCA genes actually develop breast cancer. People with these genes are more prone to breast cancer, but they aren't doomed to get it. These genetic underpinnings help to explain why one soldier witnessing a horrific experience will be diagnosed with PTSD, while the other witnessing the same event will show no symptoms. In fact, most soldiers don't develop PTSD. Of course, the likelihood of a person, even those without a strong genetic tendency, being diagnosed with PTSD increases with multiple exposures to stress and trauma. Not surprisingly, soldiers who have been deployed to war zones multiple times are at a higher risk of developing PTSD than other soldiers. Are you wired? So how do you know if you are wired in a way that would make you more likely to experience a drained brain? Of course, having a panic attack is one way. Your startle response is another common way scientists predict people who may be wired for worry. Maybe you've seen evidence of your own startle response when you're in the passenger seat of a car or in a scary movie. And, of course, family history is another predictor, since people with a family history of anxiety are more likely to be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. The general way you approach life can show you if you are wired for brain drain. Just look at what you do when faced with a big, scary, or unknown parts of life. Do you face them head on, or do you tend to shy away from them? If you are an approacher, you may be classified as a sensation seeker. If you avoid, you may be classified as a sensation avoider. And your classification as sensation seeker versus sensation avoider has been shown to correlate with worry and anxiety. If you're an avoider, you are more likely to be wired and be easily drained. Interestingly, the way you react to intense stimuli actually sheds light on what's going on in your brain. Sensation seekers process dopamine, the neurochemical of novel and thrilling experiences, differently. But since their brains tend to like and seek out dopamine, they are also more likely to engage in risky behaviors and struggle with addiction. The upside of sensation seeking? They are less sensitive to stress and trauma and are less likely to be diagnosed with PTSD. It's not just that they aren't bothered by intensely positive or negative stimuli. Research shows they prefer it. This personality trait has been shown to have strong genetic underpinnings, which is one reason addiction can run in families. But it also means they're less susceptible to becoming drained. Stressful events are less likely to cause lasting or problematic responses. This doesn't mean sensation seekers can't get brain drained, but it does likely provide them with an extra layer of protection against it when facing a stressor. On the other hand, sensation avoiders shy away from novel or intense stimuli. Instead of craving the upper dopamine in the brain, they find too much of it overwhelming. Pair these genetics with a negative experience, nurture activating nature, and you will see a problematic stress response. In an animal study, sensation avoiders, e.g. nature, who were separated from mothers when they were young, e.g. nurture, later showed a heightened stress response as adults. If you're a sensation avoider, you are less likely to be diagnosed with addiction since alcohol, cocaine, and other drugs release dopamine, a neurochemical that sensation avoiders find too activating. However, you may be more likely to experience brain drain as you release more stress hormones like cortisol and deplete your brain balancers like serotonin and GABA. This neurochemical response is more easily activated and longer lasting in sensation avoiders. Your stress response is evident at a very young age. In an experiment with 4- and 5-year-old children, the kids had to meet the researchers and participate in 45 minutes of testing. They measured the children's cortisol levels before, during, and after the experiment. Healthy children had stress hormone levels that rose in response to meeting strangers and performing tasks, and then went back to normal. These children also tended to be well-behaved and displayed higher levels of self-regulation. In other children, the stress hormone either rose and stayed high or rose quickly and then dropped. These children were rated by their teachers as aggressive and lacking self-control. In slightly older children, higher levels of cortisol were linked to academic difficulties. The researchers' analysis demonstrated that this wasn't the result of low mental ability, but rather the stress hormone affecting children's ability to learn. Now, the high cortisol levels could be the result of either nature and/or nurture, but this research shows how early a drained brain can affect people and the potential course of their lives. Consider the stressed-out 4-year-old labeled aggressive by teachers and how he or she may struggle academically as a result of that stress. He or she would be likely to receive very little positive feedback from parents and be shunned by peers, negatively affecting self-worth. The child would become an adult more likely to be in stressful situations like financial, relationship, and legal difficulties. The importance of learning healthy and natural stress management skills is vital, and the need begins at a very young age. Another surprising way to know if you are wired for drain, you have high levels of verbal intelligence. A 2014 study found a correlation between verbal intelligence and anxiety. Specifically, high levels of verbal intelligence predicted worry and rumination. Subjects were likely to agree with the statement, "I am always worrying about something." The researchers believe that with verbal intelligence comes the ability to consider past and future events in more detail, leading to the pitfall thought pattern called paralysis analysis, as the person worries, stews, and ruminates, which doesn't do anything to create action that would solve the problem. In fact, this kind of thinking prevents action. Other research has shown an association between anxiety and general intelligence. In one study, subjects with generalized anxiety disorder tended to have higher IQs. Perhaps a bit of ignorance is indeed bliss. The power of your genes. Most people who are wired for brain drain know it. I suspect that if you didn't already know, you have a much better idea after reading the previous section. But why did this happen, and how does it work? One explanation for why some people are wired for worry-induced drain is that this condition may have developed over time as a means of survival. For example, the researchers who found the correlation between higher IQs and generalized anxiety disorder suggest this may be a function of evolution. Whereas a non-anxious and intelligent person will detect some danger, the anxious and intelligent person will always be considering the possibility of danger. This would mean the anxiety and worry helped the person stay alive as he or she was perennially on the lookout for anything that could harm him or her. People wired in this way are not only more likely to see the danger, but also apt to take physical action in response. People wired for worry and brain drain process threats in a different area of the brain, the motor-specific parts that help you to quickly move out of the way of danger. People who do not suffer from anxiety, on the other hand, process these threats in the temporal region of the brain, which leads to a more passive and less physical response to threats. Another possible evolutionary theory explains why women are more likely to be wired for worry and twice as likely to be diagnosed with anxiety, which is partially due to sex hormones. Levels of estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone affect corticotropin-releasing factor, which affects the nervous system and stress response. In animal studies, both males and females engaged in anxiety-related grooming when exposed to CRF, but this reaction was especially pronounced in females with higher levels of estrogen and progesterone. What does this have to do with evolution? An enhanced stress response may help females be more responsive when protecting their young in the face of danger. The how of being wired for brain drain, how does it work, is still unclear, but there is definitely a genetic component. Research with twins shows anxiety has a simple genetic architecture. Genetic influences may be separated into two distinct categories. One study found generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and agoraphobia were affected by one genetic factor. Specific phobias, on the other hand, were associated with a different one. Social phobia was influenced by both of these distinct genetic factors. Despite these separate genes that affect different anxiety disorders, people with anxiety often don't stay neatly in one lane of their particular diagnosable condition. In fact, people with one anxiety disorder are more likely to be affected by other types of anxiety. So yes, your genes play a role. Other research that's been done to determine how genetics affect anxiety found that 20% of adults are lucky enough to have a gene variation that results in less anxiety because it leads to lower levels of something called FAAH. FAAH is a chemical that prevents the breakdown of anandamide, a feel-good chemical known as the bliss molecule, which is a naturally occurring marijuana-like substance. People with this genetic variation who use marijuana have been shown to experience less cravings for the drug when they stop using it. Unlike 80% of adults who don't have this mutation, this subset of people experience a similar natural high all the time. When scientists tested mice, the mice with this variation spent more time in the open parts of a maze. This indicates that these mice felt fearless, free, and less stressed in general. In studies with both humans and animals, people and animals with this gene variation were also able to recover more quickly from stressful and fear-provoking situations. Genes also play a role in your mood in general. If you've ever wondered how much of your general feeling of happiness is genetic, one scientist has actually put a hard number on it. Using research from identical and fraternal twin studies, she determined that 50% of your mood is genetically determined. A minuscule 10% is based on life circumstances, and a whopping 40% is based on your outlook. These numbers are actually good news for anyone who is not hardwired to be a happy-go-lucky person, since they suggest there are many ways to change your overall mood. This scientific understanding also helps to turn off the kind of thinking that begins with, I'll be happy and stress-free when... Since just 10% of your mood is based on life circumstances, changing these circumstances will make some, but not much, of a difference. That small difference, like the joy of a nicer car or a small raise at work, tends to be fleeting. It reminds me of the quote, there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. You're better off targeting your outlook and the way you perceive the world since it results in more significant and lasting change. The upsides of anxiety. Most anxious people, myself included, know there are many good things about anxiety, worry, or stress. Anxiety is an easy thing to turn to in any situation because it feels protective. It may even be protective in some instances. Maybe your quick reflexes have saved you when the driver in the car in front of you unexpectedly stepped on the brakes. Or maybe it helped you prepare for a storm so you were living in comfort when other people were suffering. Your worry may have led you to be an overachiever or a planner. You may have gotten an advanced degree and found a high-level job that makes you not have to worry about your finances. And yes, your anxiety may have helped you take you to this level. But if you let those traits go to the nth degree, you are sure to experience brain drain. It's also been shown that anxious people may be kinder in general because they have more empathy and relate to others facing a difficult period. One recent animal study found that rats given an anti-anxiety medication were less likely to free a trapped companion since the drug, like the ones more and more people around the world have turned to, lessened their empathy. Even rats will help other rats in need, unless, of course, they were too medicated to feel others' pain. Imagine how much empathy human beings may be stifling thanks to too much Xanax, Klonopin, and other benzodiazepines. So yes, anxiety does have its upsides, but don't let that deter you from mitigating its effects. Just like most other aspects of life, it's fine in moderation. Chapter 5. How drained is your brain? Hopefully by now you understand the biological and genetic underpinnings of becoming brain drained. Maybe you've begun to understand the how and why of anxiety, fear, and stress. In doing so, perhaps you have also started to befriend some of your anxiety as you see the way it has kept you safe. So now let's move on to seeing just how brain drained you are and how you might benefit from the information found in the rest of this book. There are four main ways brain drain shows up. First, it can be related to an external stressor, something that has happened to you recently. Anyone who goes through a major life change, like a loss or divorce, is going to experience a significant amount of stress. This is a very normal response. Just because it is an isolated event doesn't make the process any less difficult to get through. Second, brain drain can be psychological. In these cases, brain drain is more inside job than external stressor. These people feel anxious most of the time, because it's the way they experience life. Of course, these people tend to feel even worse when an external stressor is present, but will even persist in the absence of them. This state can be genetic, due to trauma, or even the result of seemingly benign choices like eating too many processed foods. Third, brain drain can be physical. Many people experience physical symptoms when they are brain drained. Tension, digestive problems, and a racing heart are common manifestations of anxiety and stress. For some, brain drain presents itself physically with no awareness that the cause is stress-related. It can sometimes manifest as a physical condition like indigestion or irritable bowel syndrome when the true root is a drain.